We want to welcome you once again to Wild Women Investing in Leadership Development, presenting courageous conversations with me, Dr. Kim Alexander, and Lady Shauna Whatley. We are excited today that we have joining us Dr. Karen Howard. She's going to be sharing with us some information about mental health today.
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Kim, and thank you all for joining us today. We're particularly excited to have an amazing African-American woman sharing with us today. To give you a little bit of background about Karen Howard, Karen currently serves as the Advocacy Manager for Mental Health America under the Vice President of Mental Health Systems and Advocacy. She has 10 years experience in political campaigns and advocacy. As Advocacy Manager, Howard builds the MHA Regional Policy Council's four-year annual conference, compiles resources, and advises strategies to influence federal and state elected officials on a wide range of healthcare, education, criminal justice policy issues, and facilities relationship building between MHA affiliates and their state and local elected officials through the Back Home campaign. Howard earned a BA in political science at Spelman College, the nation's top-ranked historically Black college and university, for 10 years. Howard continues leadership in the community as board chair of the African American Woman on the Hill Network and founder and director of the Oakland Mills High School Alumni Program in Columbia, Maryland. It is very important to her that mental health promotion becomes a core foundation of our nation's health and education policy and programs. We are thrilled to have you here sharing with us today about mental health and how our community can be better served in this health issue area. So thank you so much for joining us, Karen.
Thank you so much, First Lady Whatley, Shauna Whatley, and Dr. Alexander. It's really an honor and pleasure to be here, and I'm just so grateful that you all have this platform for developing and leading women of faith in particular.
Yes, we are so excited that you are here and looking forward to sharing this time together, especially around the topic of mental health. And it's not often that we get a chance to be around women of color who are moving and doing incredible things in the field of mental health. And I want you just to share with us just a little bit about how you got into this field, what motivated you to go there, and is there some personal story behind why you have a passion for this?
Absolutely. There's a saying that everything is personal. So most of the people who are big mental health advocates either themselves have a personal lived experience or a family member. And we know about 1 in 5 people experiences a mental health condition at some point throughout their lifetime. So this really affects all of us. If we have a family member of 5, then that's 1 person in our family. For me, I had a traumatic childhood experience. My mother died when I was 8 years old. She was a wonderful community leader and mother. And I was subsequently raised by my father and in a home full of all guys, 3 brothers, alpha men. I was the only girl. So for me, I started experiencing nervousness and anxiousness in high school and was diagnosed with anxiety and depression in college. Some of the symptoms that I was having were kind of inability to focus and concentrate. I had my grades dropped. I had academic impact. I was experiencing a sense of hopelessness and helplessness. And then that developed into lack of motivation. Once I finally received a diagnosis, it felt almost like a big burden was lifted off of my shoulder. And I felt like, wow, there's actually a reason that I'm experiencing these feelings and these thoughts that were not always positive. And I had a path to recovery that started to work, and that included therapy, medication. I had a great support system in my family. Even though I was really scared to open up at first because of the kind of taboo around mental health conditions, and because of the importance of men, and I think Black men in particular, feeling that masculinity has to do with not showing signs of weakness, I wasn't sure if they were going to be open to talking about my mental health and how their mental health might be impacted by our mother's death, or how they had to kind of grow up quickly. But I actually found support and care. And I think that's one thing that's really important for anyone's recovery. It's that you have a support system. And so once I had a little bit of work experience on the Hill and in political campaigning and finance, I realized that I was truly passionate about changing the stigma and the access to services and helping people to understand kind of the inner conflicts and battles that they might be going through, and changing policy in that area so that people won't face as many barriers to treatment. I've found that, you know, going to the doctor's office for a mental health condition was very different than going for a broken ankle or a sprained arm or something physical. Finding barriers in getting that insurance company to pay for something like that. You had to get a pre-authorization. There was a certain number of sessions that you could have. And I found that none of these same, and what they're called is non-qualitative treatment limitations, applied to surgical and medical benefits. So it became a passion of mine to really, kind of change from a generalist to getting specific, and I was able to kind of network my way into the field. And I'm really glad to be at the nonprofit organization I am now, Mental Health America, which is the oldest consumer advocacy organization. It was started in 1909, and we currently operate in the philosophy of before stage four, where we think there should be prevention of mental health conditions for all, early intervention for those at risk of developing a mental health condition, integrated services and supports that are community-based for those who need them, understanding that recovery is the goal, and overall, over 90% of people that experience a mental health condition can live a productive life that is fulfilling to them in their community. There's only a very small population of people that may not be able to live in the community with their family and friends.
Wow, thanks so much for sharing that. It's so important. I'm so glad we're having this conversation, and it really is a courageous conversation because, as you stated, many in the African American community and beyond see mental health as a stigma. And so can you talk to us a little bit about, can you define for us behavioral health, and what does that encompass?
Absolutely. So behavioral health encompasses both mental health conditions and substance use disorders. Mental health conditions range from, there are over thousands of them in the DSM-5, which was a list compiled by psychiatrists, and they range from anxiety to phobia to depression to psychosis or having verbal or auditory hallucinations. They can include eating disorders as well as other phobias or irrational fears. When we talk about behavioral health, that also includes substance use disorders. And the number one abused substance in America is alcohol. So alcoholism, though it doesn't kill as many people as opioid use disorder has, it does affect thousands and tens of thousands of families across America. And people with substance use disorders, over 40% of the time, have a co-occurring mental health condition that they're trying to self-medicate or self-treat. And if you don't already have a mental health condition when you develop that addiction, a lot of the times you develop one after the addiction starts because of the impact that the substances have on the body and the brain. So some other, we have, yes, alcohol, opiates is our national epidemic currently, which, as you know, is brought up some talk about race because of the response to opiates killing people at such high rates in the 2000s versus when heroin and other opiates were killing Black Americans in the 1980s and 1990s. So more recently, there has been kind of talk about the double standard between how national leaders addressed the opioid epidemic that we're seeing. And behavioral health, yes, encompasses both of those things, mental and substance use disorders.
Yeah. As we really have this courageous conversation about our community and the taboo around mental health, I want you to kind of share with us as we think about it, people are not often running to seek help. What are some things that we can do to change that? How can we begin to increase the awareness? And especially as you talk about the relationship between alcoholism and substance abuse and mental health and how they can co-occur.
Thank you for the question, Dr. Alexander. So I'll start by just sharing some prevalence. Depression is the number one disability worldwide. 20% of the US population experiences a mental health condition at any given time. And 66% of people who need treatment do not receive it. With respect to Black Americans in particular, adult Black Americans are more likely than white Americans to report serious psychological distress. Black American teenagers are more likely to attempt suicide than our white teenagers. Black Americans of all ages are more likely to be victims of serious violent crime, making them more likely to meet the diagnostic criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And despite progress made over the years, I'd be remiss if we didn't also discuss racism and the impact that oppression and racism has on mental health, as well as how media covers police violence against Black Americans. So a couple of things that I think are really important for finding recovery or seeking help. Number one is taking a self-assessment. Mental Health America has screenings online. They're private, confidential, and free that you can use to check in with yourself at www.mhascreening.org. The screenings that are available are for depression, anxiety, psychosis, some of the disorders I mentioned earlier, as well as postpartum for women during their pregnancy period. That's a very new screen that we're really excited to have. And the same screens that you would take in a doctor's office are what we're presenting online that you can take. Once you get your results after answering the questions, you can opt to provide like a profile of information about your background and demographics, whether you have other co-occurring conditions. And then you receive more information just generally about that condition that you screened for. I think that the second step in getting help is just researching and finding out as much information as you can on your emotional and mental health. And so a lot of resources are also on MHA's website for that. We also work with other organizations as well. So you'll see partner websites that you can link to, we share information as well as NAMI shares information. A lot of people take the NAMI community education courses. There is like the American Psychological Association also has resources on their website. So I would say as you're seeking help for yourself, try to educate yourself about what you might be feeling and what that means. And you'll find that so many other people are out there experiencing some of the exact same things and that you're just not alone. Although experiencing a certain emotionality or even hallucinations might feel like a very scary and lonely experience. It's not unique. Our bodies are all different, but a lot of people can experience some of the same things, and there is treatment out there. So assess yourself, find as much information as you can to equip yourself with what you might be experiencing that has already been researched and that there's already treatment for. And then the third thing I would say is ensure that you have a support system in place, whether that's family by blood, whether it's family that's chosen, like a church family or other group, whether it's friends or others in the community that you can rely upon to be there for you. And that's one thing that's just really important. People sometimes aren't sure how to help a friend or family member that may be experiencing a mental health condition or crisis. And I think just presence, whether that's virtual presence on a Zoom call or, auditory presence on a phone call or physical presence in person, that presence and just being there, not having to say any words, is the most powerful type of support you can have.
Sure. Wow. There's so much information. I'm glad to hear about all the resources that are available. I guess I was about maybe 24, 25, I went through a season of depression, and it was triggered by a situation in my life that I wasn't dealing with very well. And I was also in graduate school, and I'll never forget the loneliness I felt because I didn't know how to deal with it because I had never dealt with anything like that before. And then I was ashamed because here I was, high achiever, doing well in graduate school, and what did I have to be depressed about, right? So, and I had to really, I went to the doctor, and the psychiatrist was like, well, let's give you some medication, and this can help you get through it. And I shunned the medication, but I'm like, no way, I'm a Christian, I'm not going on drugs, I can fight through this, which I did, but if I could do it over again, I just could have been in a better place faster had I been open to taking the medication. And I think I think we've made progress in this area, but as, young, and that's why my passion is for young women, because I know that age is such a difficult age. And so many things in life can happen to you at that age. But I'm excited to hear that there are, we've made progress, but how do you all work with, educating our community in particular that, yes, God can see you through, but there's also help, on the medication side, how do you balance that? How do you work with?
Yes, I think that the number one thing that we can do is share our stories. And one way that Mental Health America does that is through our Minority Mental Health Month, which was, as of last week, no longer called that. It's called Black, Indigenous, and People of Color Month. Awesome. And we highlight the stories of people of color on our social media, in our blog posts. We have particular programming on our podcast, which is the Fight in the Open podcast. And we invite speakers to come to panels. I don't know if you're familiar with some of the really great mental health leadership in the DMV, but they're in the Black community, but there's Dr. Alfie Breland Noble, who's a psychologist and researcher, and sits currently on Congresswoman Bonnie Watson Coleman's Emergency Task Force on Black Youth Suicide, and helped introduce legislation for Black youth to get equity in the medical system for their mental health care. There's Renshawn Miller, who is a young Black vocal activist. He sat on a panel with Dr. Breland Noble and shared how, you know, he felt shame experiencing depression in undergrad, or depression in undergrad. And then once he found out he was bipolar, which is actually a disorder that combines both periods of manic and depression. So you're experiencing these extremes. You're going kind of back and forth with high highs and low lows. And he talks about the shame that he felt and really fights against that. He does some really good programming. We're really fortunate in the DMV to have a lot of providers here. And I'm an advocate of going to see psychiatrists. I will say that I thought it was a sin to go see a psychiatrist until a woman in my church told me, you know, you can go, just check it out. If there's nothing there, you didn't lose anything. But if it is something, then they'll be able to catch it for you. I thought that I was basically telling God in a blasphemous way that he wasn't able to do all things if I went to see a psychiatrist. And I think in our community, the more conversations we have about the science of psychology, the actual medical history behind psychology and psychiatry, and that it's okay to both pray and take medicine, just yes. like you would for diabetes or yes. hypertension mm-hmm. or cancer. You can do both, and God loves you and uses you no less mm-hmm. than if you did not take medicine. So I think, though I think it's important to see psychiatrists, if you're not at that point, but you do want to seek professional help, you can get that from a psychologist. Mm-hmm. You can get that from a mental health therapist. You can get it from a licensed professional counselor. And honestly, I am a big fan of social workers. Mm-hmm. The best mm-hmm. therapist that I had, the woman gave me homework. She gave me different things to think about. She gave me mantras to say. She was the most engaged person, and they come from the social justice angle, mm-hmm. is social workers. So if yeah. you find you're looking for a professional, to seek appropriate medical care and just to check in with yourself with a professional, you can do so. And I encourage everyone to go to their insurance company's website if you have health insurance, and you can do a directory search for medical providers and behavioral health providers. If that is something that you've not necessarily taken time to do, you usually have to create a login, you have to kind of navigate the website. I encourage people, just pick up the phone, call your member services line and say, hey, I want a Black woman psychiatrist with experience in complicated grief. That's what I had to do. And by the way, it took them almost 2 weeks to get back to me. So we know that there are barriers in the medical system, mm-hmm. not just within the shame and kind of the stigma of mental health, which is getting better, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. But there is also inadequate workforce, especially for Black Americans and people of color. The network of doctors that are in our health insurance companies don't reflect the demographics of us. They don't right. reflect, even though, you know, Black people make up 13% of the US population, we're only 5% of the physician workforce. Mm-hmm. And that number gets even smaller when you talk about behavioral health because of the low reimbursement rates. And, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of Black people are determined to rise into the next class. And I mean, that determination comes mm-hmm. from a place of wanting to help their family and make sure that their families are taken care of and their children are taken care of for the future. But that means that going into behavioral health, which has historically lower reimbursement rates mm-hmm. for the same things that other doctors do, is just kind of a non-starter for many.
Yeah. I think our society places values. I think we see that in so many areas in the wrong places when it comes to places where we have need. And, you know, as I listen to you, one of the things that really, really jumps out at me is this concept of sharing our stories. I think the enemy's desire is to isolate us and make us feel like we're the only one. And if nothing else, getting us to just stop the silence and to seek professional help. And that means being honest and real with those that we're close to about what's going on in our lives and being not being ashamed. And I think for me personally, you know, going through menopause, I didn't know there were going to be some psychological changes and some things that were going on. And because my mother was no longer alive, it was no one that I could talk to. But luckily, when I went to for a regular physical and I mentioned that I was starting to feel a little off, that my doctor was like, well, you know, that could be part of what you're going through is part of menopause. And I was like, wait a minute, nobody told me that that was going to be part of this experience. Mm-hmm. But unless we share those things with one another, we'll never really get to the point of understanding that it's okay to say that, you know, I don't really feel like myself, or I'm struggling here. And I think as a culture, we are raised as women to just be so strong and to be able to juggle, you know, so many balls at the same time. And, you know, don't let them see you, you know, struggle, or don't let them see you crack. And it's been killing us to be able to hold all that in. And so I'm hoping that as we raise daughters and sons in this next generation, our ability to talk about this and have a courageous conversation is there. And one of the things that also struck me in your introduction was your passion for access to services and changing policies. And when you talked about how just in this last piece about how, you know, the access to the services and waiting 2 weeks, and what are some of the things that from a policy standpoint you see that could be possible that we need to get behind?
Absolutely. So I will say that undoubtedly the best legislation for changing the game for mental health services and access was the Affordable Care Act, because it made mental health and substance use benefits an essential health benefit that all health insurance plans had to cover at parity, which meant without additional co-pays, without treatment limitations. It just had to be there. And that expansion allowed virtually anyone who was buying health insurance, whether it was through the individual market or through your employer, to be able to get mental health care. Prior to the Affordable Care Act, you know, a lot of women could not get maternity care on health plans. People had a difficult time getting mental health and substance use benefits, and that's because health plans were created to exclude those specific benefits because they thought they were too expensive to cover. Mm-hmm. So anytime you hear someone say that you don't think President Obama did anything for Black people, tell them that the Affordable Care Act expanded access to mental health services and benefits. And we need to make sure that regardless of what the Supreme Court's decision is at the end of this year, and what the election results are at the end of this year, that we stand for the law that makes sure everyone has access to mental health services and benefits. And additionally, the law expanded Medicaid. Not many people are familiar with Medicaid and the difference between Medicaid and Medicare. In particular, Medicare is mostly for older adults with working history, and Medicaid is for lower income people that may or may not be able to work and are on disability, or pregnant women with children who otherwise don't have insurance. And Medicaid is the number one payer of mental health services. So when Medicaid was expanded to childless adults that make up to 130% of the federal poverty level, that granted health insurance coverage for many people who were low income and had undiagnosed mental health conditions. And so these are people that are taking care of other people in their homes or working two or three jobs, but the jobs don't offer health insurance. Or they may be kind of between jobs because they have temporary or seasonal work, but spend their time otherwise helping in the community or at home. So those two things are really, really important. In terms of what people can do now, we have an action alert on the website, on MHA's website, to ask the House representative, the House of Representatives, to place on the suspension calendar a bill that would change the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is a 1-800 number that is very hard to remember. I can't even remember what it is, but it's used in times of crisis. To change that to a three-digit number, 988. 988 would be a universal number that you could call from any cell phone or home landline and be transferred to the Suicide Prevention Lifeline to get services. There's also a number of other bills out there that I can talk to, but I think that the most important thing we really need to get behind is ensuring that people with mental health and substance use disorders who are experiencing homelessness are not put in jail and criminalized for that, for the lack of services out there, and that we grow our mental health workforce, including by increasing the numbers of providers in schools for children. I'll say one more thing. So not only, I think it's really important that we talk about access in the medical system through ACA and Medicaid. We have to get behind crisis services for people who need treatment right now in the minute because they're contemplating suicide or they're going through a life change like a breakup or a job loss or something traumatic that's happened and they're not sure that life is worth living anymore. That's the 988 number that we need to get past. And then we need to get universal screening for children in schools and in pediatric settings so that there's just a regular well checkup for any child. And we need to integrate behavioral health into primary care so that, you know, your family doctor is more comfortable providing mental health advice, or they're right next to and co-located with a psychiatrist or psychologist that they can just refer someone to right away. Mm-hmm. And though that practice transformation has incredible results, and we've seen that through the collaborative care model, which prepares primary care family doctors to either consult with a behavioral health specialist for a patient or refer that patient directly. And it's been especially useful for children. And if we can decrease the number of children that grow up to be adults with untreated mental health conditions, that will improve things overall, because 50% of mental health conditions present themselves and manifest in different ways by age 14. Mm. 75% of them present themselves by age 24. So that's why between those developing ages from 14 to 24, a lot of people experience their first or second or third kind of thing that's like, man, something is off, but I'm not quite sure what it is. That's why a lot of college age students right now are experiencing, you know, a huge crisis, but they don't have services or treatment available to them because college campuses are not equipped. So during that time, before adulthood, it's really when we need to get, you know, children services and information and just the support that they need to grow up and out of their mental health conditions, because we know that if you catch it early, you can reduce a lot of irreparable damage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. There's so much information, and we just have to make sure that we're sharing and educating our people in our communities and using our organizations to partner with your organization to make sure that we're educating our young adults, our children, as well as adults, as it relates to mental health. I want to step back and discuss, you know, a policy that is before the Congress right now As you know, we're dealing with all these issues, social justice issues and issues with the police. And one of the things that I've been encouraged about is the pieces of legislation that have been introduced is really trying to tackle the issue of mental health, in that it should not be policed, it should not be criminalized. And I'm very, very excited about that. If we can take that step and ensure that legislation is brought to bear to deal with that issue, I think it'll be a major, major step in the right direction in righting a lot of the wrongs that have been meted out against our people, and criminalizing, you know, our young Black men, when oftentimes there was a mental health issue associated with why they were in trouble in the first place. And so I would love to hear about what your organization is doing. Are you all, have you all endorsed the legislation that Senator Harris and Senator Booker have introduced along with the Congressional Black Caucus? I know Senator Scott also introduced his piece of legislation as well. There are some, you know, major discrepancies, but I try to be hopeful that they can come together and really have something substantive that comes out of both. But would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yes, thank you so much. I actually led a session explaining to our staff yesterday about the two bills in the House and Senate on policing reform. And I've been following the hearings very closely on police use of force. I'm very encouraged by the work that's happening and the clear line drawn between whether or not an officer needs to escalate or de-escalate a situation. And one thing that MHA has been behind and been involved in training officers on, and even continuing to kind of share with local police departments across the country, is crisis intervention training. So that is a training for police officers, which is teaching them how to engage with a person that may be in a mental health crisis. And the tactics that they use are exactly the opposite of what they're taught to do otherwise. So using force, using weapons, all of that is kind of unlearned. And the officers are retrained on how to engage with a person in a non-threatening way that might allow for that person to be open to being transported to get some help, like from a peer respite. Peer supporters are people with lived experience of a mental health condition that spend their time working with other people who are just starting their recovery. And peer support is wildly successful in helping reduce hospitalizations, in helping to help people even engage with the mental health system. Some people feel more comfortable talking to a peer than a psychiatrist or other person that they may mistrust. And there is a generational divide, I will say, in trust in our medical system because of experiments such as the Henrietta Lacks experiment and the Tuskegee experiment and all of this unethical behavior that happened, which penalized and harmed Black people. It's understandable that there is mistrust, but peers can help kind of rebuild that within a system. And so Mental Health America is totally on board with the police reform bills and has been sharing information with Congresswoman Bass's office and Nadler's office and Scott and Senators Scott and Harris and Booker's offices on how we want to decouple the idea of mental illness as being violent, because that's really a myth. People with mental health conditions are more likely to be victims of violence, not perpetuating violence. And we've seen that up to 25% of the people who are killed by police have a mental health condition. So if we know that there's so many Black men killed by police, and a quarter of them at least have mental health conditions, that's inappropriate use of force. And so it really hits home for me because I have a family member who was killed by police, and a lot of this has brought up, you know, has been triggering for me. I wrote a poem that I shared with our team that I think helped really inform them about the Black experience and how, you know, traumatic killings of Black people are on TV, because it hits too close to home for us.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, absolutely. I'm glad to hear you just bring up this issue of oppression and racism, and I'm glad that Mental Health America is behind the police reform bills. And as we think about the change that we're dealing with just on a daily basis, since we have been in COVID-19 stay in place, and even in stage one and two, just adjusting to change on an everyday level, aside from a pandemic, and then to add the second pandemic on top of it, it's just overwhelming. What are some of the issues you think we need to combat depression in this season of dealing with oppression and racism and the pandemic and the fear of going out or not going out? It just seems to be so many more things for us to manage. And I know our children are not dealing well, but us as adults, we're not dealing well either. So if you could just speak to that, I think it would be helpful.
Sure. So you definitely hit something, and you hit the nail on the head when you said that we're all trying to cope, and some of us are not feeling like we're doing it very well, because it's one thing layered on top of the other. And so just start by saying that we all have to give ourselves grace. And this is something that we have to do each and every day. We have to remind our friends and family members to do it. We have to remind ourselves to do it. But giving yourself grace, these are not typical circumstances. There is an entire global shift that's happening in energy, in resources, in, you know, I just think of the fact that protests were happening in over 30 countries at the same time, what that means for the atmosphere, you know, what that means, all of the speaking that was happening, all of the truths that were being told, how that changes the way that, you know, we speak to our plants, or we speak to our children, or we speak to things that we grow, and we also speak into the air, and those things manifest. So there's a huge shift that's happening, and our bodies are going to have to, you know, figure out how to deal and how to process all of that. But I think a part of it is stepping back and giving yourself grace, and knowing that you're going through probably anxiety related to COVID, plus crises related to being in quarantine and social distancing, plus you're grieving the old life that you used to have, plus there may be grief and bereavement issues of people that you've lost, or a job that you had, or some other financial change that you don't have any control over. And then on top of that, you have police killings and the constant news cycle that has no issue repeating the violence against men. I personally have not watched the George Floyd video of 8 minutes and 46 seconds of him being kneeled on until death, because for me, it's too triggering. I think of my family member. But to see that over and over in the media certainly has an effect. And then on top of that, for parents to be parenting and homeschooling and trying to teach and educate your kids and maybe create rituals like cooking at home or things that enrich them, while on top of that, managing your 9 to 5, yeah, right, your, you know, 60-hour week or 70-hour week typically, there are a lot of things that are getting in the way of being stable right now. So I think you have to protect your sleep schedule and ensure that you're getting a certain number of hours of sleep per day. And that means shutting off the computer and the TV and the cell phone by a certain time, Because if you have that protected sleep, you have a higher likelihood of your body really shutting down and being able to enjoy REM and be rested and restored. And usually anxiety and bipolar disorder is triggered by lack of sleep. So if you're experiencing insomnia, you really want to try to get a hold of that right away, whether that means maybe doing some type of physical activity or creating a ritual, really shutting all the lights off and ensuring you're protecting your sleep is really important. Eating very nutritious foods like produce and whole foods and whole grains, and lean protein like beans and yogurt and nuts, ensuring that you're getting lots of fresh fruit and vegetables, leafy greens. I try to eat spinach, kale, or collards every day. It doesn't happen, but I try. Broccoli, the more green on your plate, the better. 30 minutes of exercise a day improves your brain. So Elver, I know everyone's heard the studies, but your physical health ties to your mental health because of the endorphins and other chemicals that our brain releases during physical activity. If you can get the 30 minutes in all at one time, great, wonderful. If that's not something that you can really do with the schedule that you have right now, try to do 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, another 5 minutes here. As long as you're getting it in, that's all that really matters. The sleep, exercise, eating good food, meditation. Prayer and meditation is really something that, the faith organizations and the faith community uses to decompress without people really knowing it. But prayer and meditation can be so grounding in ways for people of faith that it can have the effects or impacts of like taking a medicine or something like that. So if you're taking medicine and working out 30 minutes a day and eating nutritiously and praying and meditating for whatever time you designate is important to you, you're creating a recipe for winning. And these things you may not be able to do every single day, but if you try to pick one or two and you make that time, moms have the whole world on their shoulders. As a childless, motherless woman, I will say that the value of a mom just cannot be understated. And I'm just so encouraged by the work and the gifts that women give to their families, which are building blocks of society and keep the world go round, really. And then how the power structure in America really disenfranchises women to think that their sacrifices and their contributions are less important than what a man might bring to the table. And so I think as parents and as women, we have to almost overvalue what we're bringing to the table.
That's another podcast altogether.
Yeah, I think you do. That overvalue what you're bringing to the table, because women have, the intuition and the emotional intelligence and the gift of multitasking and the balancing and all of that women do. But I will say Black women are doing it to a detriment. So what we have to do is say no and get comfortable with saying no. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to just share some results of the screenings that African-American women were taking on Mental Health America's website. The Black women population taking screenings, that's from anxiety, depression, to psychosis, eating disorder, what have you. The Black women were older than the general population of screeners. So more women were between 25 and 34 and 35 to 44 than the general population. So this is almost your poise group of ladies that are looking, they're reaching out, looking for help, but they're not sure what to do yet. Black women are actually more likely to be receiving current mental health treatment than the general population of screeners. So I think that goes to show that we're getting treatment, but it's not working. It's either not evidence-based or it's not effective. There's some missing component. Perhaps there's some barrier in with the provider that they're not seeing the issues that these women are going through. And also women, Black women or Black people are more likely to be misdiagnosed. So if you think that your provider is wrong when you get a diagnosis, or that doesn't quite sound right when you're looking up all the information about a condition, get a second opinion, get a third opinion. Say, look, you know, this doesn't sound quite right. I'm gonna go check it out with another professional. I appreciate your help. Thank you so much. We know our bodies and our minds and our feelings better than any doctor does. So we have to be our best advocates. Mm-hmm. And we're not taught that in the medical system. We have to really speak up for what we're feeling because, you know, Black women die at higher rates in pregnancy, during pregnancy. Black people in general were not given pain treatment at the same rate as white people. So Black people are experiencing more pain, chronic pain over time than white people are. That is devastating to the community because if you have a community of people who are working and hurting and suffering every day, there's gonna be an emotional impact on that. And I will say that Black women who come to MHA's website and take a screen are more likely to be caregivers. Mm. So in that sense, we have the burden sometimes of caregiving for our children as well as our parents. We're kind of doing all of, you know, both kind of the three generations of care, if you include your own self-care.
And grandchildren.
And grandchildren. So we really have to figure out what boundaries we're going to draw and be resolute about it and unapologetic about it and know that God will give us grace for it, for the people that let us down, and know that if someone is upset by our decision, that they will eventually get over it, and that the most important thing is giving from a cup that's full. Because when you feel empty, you're not able to really give to others. And that's something that I learned from my dad. I was very early on, I think I, you know, wanted my hands in this pot and that pot, and I was in this organization and doing that and volunteering here, but I was not happy. And my dad said, Karen, you don't need to be doing any of that unless you feel good. And so maybe cut back on one or two things. You can still be involved. And so for me, I'm figuring out that balance of being involved in the social scene, being involved in the community organizing, and also taking time for myself to assess, take inventory of how I'm doing. And really for me, one of the biggest challenges was just asking for help. Sometimes I just needed help and I didn't know what words to say. I didn't know how to start the conversation. I didn't know if I'd be a burden on the woman or male that I was asking for help from, whether it was for school or work or personal development or business entrepreneurship. I think it's really important that as we say no and set the boundaries for our self-care, that we also get comfortable with asking for help. That can be professional help. That can be help from friends or family members or other people in the community. But I think as much as we can feel that we can do it all on our own, which we are doing it all on our own. I think over time we'll find that will come to a breaking point. And so we want to teach our children to have and our community to have healthy modes of operating and healthy modes of of saying yes and no, and why, knowing why we're doing that and fulfilling our purpose in those decisions.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. Being, I think Dr. Kim and myself were very guilty of always saying yes until we finally hit a wall and had to acknowledge, like, we can't keep going at this pace. It just wasn't good for us. It wasn't good for our families. It wasn't good for, you know, the organizations in which we serve. And ultimately, you know, God couldn't use us to the best of our abilities to glorify His kingdom if we weren't at in a better place and space, and just recognizing we need rest and rejuvenation. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why we started our retreat. About rejuvenation, because we realized just in our own experiences that it was needed. It was needed. And, you know, just thank God for our relationship, because we're our accountability partners. When you say you need support, you need to have a support system. It's important that you have sisters who will check you when needed, when they see you doing a little bit too much and not taking care of yourselves. Mm-hmm. One of my family members, she's a mental health provider, and she shared a self-evaluation with me that I'll just share on the call, because I thought it was so catchy, and I find myself doing it all the time. She said you have to do a PIES check, and that's P-I-E-S-S, PIES check, and you have to check with yourself how you're doing physically, how you're doing intellectually, how you're doing emotionally, how you're doing socially, and ultimately how you're doing spiritually. And if any of those things are off, then you need to, you know, say, okay, what do I need to get back in balance?
I really like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's great. I think it's, I'm going to have to switch it around. I'm going to say spies.
Well,
so I'm going to, so that she doesn't, but I'll give her credit.
Well, you know what? I think she would be, because I asked her, I was like, did you make that up? And she's like, no, I heard it at this conference that was actually for Black men, Black boys. Oh. And a mental health provider had shared that with young Black boys. So it was something catchy that they could, you know, grab onto. And I'm like, well, it's perfect for me. And I just, you know, every once in a while, I just do a self-evaluation. Like, okay, where am I in these areas in my life? And if something's not quite right, then I need to figure out how I get back into balance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah. So please do share, and I'll be sure to tell her that I gave her credit. It's just been such a blessing. This has been an amazing, amazing conversation. I'm so thankful. I'm so thankful that you made yourself available. And because, you know, Dr. Kim and I have been talking about doing something related to mental health, and we hadn't gotten to it. And I think part of it was we couldn't figure out who was the right person to bring in. And right. God brought you to us, because you were the exact person that we needed to talk to be able to share the resources that your organization has, and just to share your experiences. And thank you for sharing your personal story. Mm-hmm. It's just been moving, and I'm sure you will bless others as they listen in on this courageous conversation.
Yes, we've enjoyed having you, Karen Howard, talking a little bit about Mental Health America and just the recipe for winning. I think that's going to stick with me for a while. The recipe for winning, making sure we're shutting off and turning off our devices and getting better sleep and eating and praying and working out and creating some healthy boundaries so that we're able to be available, and then asking for help, not being afraid to let each other know. And then, you know, I'll add that last piece, because Lady Shauna and I, that sense of community and being able to share with one another and keep each other accountable, and say to each other sometimes, why don't you just take a nap?
Exactly.
Oh, man. You guys don't know. There's a nap ministry.
It's so counterculture, though, I think, for us as African-American females. You know, we feel like we have to be doing something all the time. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we feel guilty when we just take a moment.
Exactly. Yes. So yesterday, my kids told me to go take a nap. which was good because I really have been talking to them more about creating healthy balance and getting rest and modeling that. So when I'm not, they're able to call me on it. And so it was good. This was very refreshing. Thank you so much for this time. Thank you for the information. Thank you for the work that you're doing as it relates to policy and change. And we'll be lifting you up in prayer.
Thank you so battlefield, much, ladies. Yeah. This opportunity was absolutely wonderful. I could never turn it down. I would love to do another session if you guys have. And I'll just end by saying I'm going to take a walk in nature, and that's going to help be my self-care for today. Mm-hmm. And if anyone needs free therapy, Dark Beauty, DRK Beauty, is donating 10,000 hours of free mental health therapy to women of color during this time.
Thank you so much. That's so much important information. You know, you sent out an email with a lot of resources listed. And if I would just love for us to be able to share that with our network. And so if you give us permission, we will absolutely send that out to other First Ladies, because they have a network of their own, you know, at their churches. And just so they'll know, there are organizations out here that are willing to partner and be of service.
Absolutely, and I'll make sure that I send you, I have a listserv, it's DMV Mental Health, and I'll make sure that I send you our July toolkit, which will have resources for Black people and in, you know, gauging and tools and tips for better mental health.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for joining Wild Courageous Conversations.
Thank you.